This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
And good morning to you. 76 degrees, huh? That's the spirit. Boo. Good morning, everyone. On that note, this is Greg Wilkins with the business section of the New York Times. And today is Sunday, April 28th, 2024. This first article today, guess who's back in the air? Delta Airlines flight loses emergency slide after takeoff, officials say. The plane had taken off from Kennedy International Airport when crew members noticed problems near its right wing. What became of the slide is unknown. This article is written by Isabella Kwai. A Boeing 767 plane flown by Delta Airlines lost an emergency slide on Friday, prompting it to return to New York not long after takeoff, officials said. The flight, Delta Airlines 520, had left Kennedy International Airport in New York and was headed to Los Angeles when its crew discovered an issue related to the aircraft's right wing emergency exit slide. Crew members also detected an unusual sound near the wing, Delta said. Pilots declared an emergency to air traffic controllers and the flight returned to Kennedy and landed safely, the airline said. After the plane landed, it became apparent that the aircraft's emergency slide had separated from the plane, Delta Airlines said. The plane was removed from service, and the airline said it would thoroughly evaluate the aircraft. Delta flight crews enacted their extensive training and followed procedures to return to JFK, the company said in a statement, adding it would fully cooperate with retrieval efforts and investigations. It was not clear on Saturday what caused the slide to detach or where it had fallen. The Federal Aviation Administration said on Friday that it would investigate what happened. The flight, which had been scheduled to take off at 7:15 a.m., returned to the airport at 8:35 a.m. after its crew reported a vibration, the FAA said in a statement. The 176 passengers disembarked and traveled to Los Angeles on a different plane. Slides have previously fallen from planes while in midair. In July, an emergency slide from a United Airlines-operated plane crashed into a home near O'Hare Airport in Chicago. In the year 2019, a slide from a Delta plane fell into a yard in Massachusetts. A spokesman for Boeing referred inquiries about the plane that lost its slide on Friday to Delta Airlines. That plane, a version of the Boeing 767, was manufactured in the year 1990. With travel shut down in 2020, American Airlines announced at the time it had moved forward with plans to retire its 767 fleet. Boeing has also faced heightened scrutiny recently over the manufacturing of its Boeing 737 MAX jets. Two crashes in 2018 and 2019 that killed nearly 350 people raised safety concerns about the planes. In January, a fuselage panel tore off an Alaska Airlines flight, exposing passengers to a frightening ordeal as winds whipped through the cabin. Nobody was injured, but the pilots were forced to make an emergency landing, and the FAA grounded some 170 Boeing 737 MAX 9 planes as a precaution. Since then, Boeing has said it would make changes to its quality control processes, and regulators have pushed the manufacturer to make improvements in safety. Boeing does it again. This next article, he paid $13 for $13,000 Cartier earrings, and then the jeweler noticed. When Rogelio Villarreal bought a rose-colored earrings for a price that the luxury retailer said was a mistake, he looked to a Mexican consumer protection law. He later said the company delivered the earrings. This article is written by Emily Schmall. Rogelio Villarreal knew nothing about the French jeweler Cartier, he said, when an ad popped up on his Instagram feed last December. He clicked on it, perusing the pages of bling and other luxury items, including handbags, watches, and necklaces, each listed for thousands of dollars. Then Mr. Villarreal, who lived in Mexico, noticed a pair of earrings. Slender, studded 18-carat rose gold cuffs lined with diamonds, priced at just 237 Mexican pesos, or about $13. I was amazed to see how much the necklaces cost and so on, and I said, someday, until I saw the earrings, Mr. Villarreal, age 27, wrote on social media. I swear, I broke out in a cold sweat. He bought two pair. Later, the price for the earrings was adjusted on the Cartier website to 237,000 pesos, more than $13,000. The purchase initiated a months-long tussle between Mr. Villarreal, a surgery resident from the northern state of Tamaulipas, and Cartier, with hundreds of social media users following along, some cheering, some taunting, and even a Mexican senator weighing in on the dispute. But Mr. Villarreal said on Friday he had received the earrings for the steeply discounted price and noted that he had a special person in mind to be their recipient. I'm excited, he said, especially for my mom. Those earrings are for her. The sweet deal did not come without some resistance. Within a week of the purchase, Mr. Villarreal said, Carter began a series of attempts to cancel the order, initially saying that the earrings were not available. When Mr. Villarreal made no move to cancel the order, he started receiving phone calls from company representatives. He said they told him that the earrings I'd ordered were not at the correct price, which is why they wanted to cancel the purchase, and that because of the inconvenience, they would give me a gift. As compensation, the company then offered a gesture from the House of Cartier, a complimentary bottle of Cartier Cuvée Champagne, and a leather Cartier item, according to an email sent to Mr. Villarreal. He decided to reject the gifts and fight back, using a contact form on the company's website to cite a federal consumer protection law in Mexico that says a goods supplier can be taken to court by not respecting the terms and conditions under which a product or service is purchased. Cartier has not responded to several requests for comment. Mr. Villarreal found the terms and conditions for sales on Cartier's website in Mexico, which state that any dispute could be brought to the Office of the Federal Prosecutor for the Consumer for conciliation. So, he did just that. He filed a complaint with the Matamoros branch of the Federal Consumer Protection Agency. That agency, which has a role similar to that of the Federal Trade Commission in the United States, has a history of intervening on behalf of consumers when retailers change list prices after a sale. In February, the consumer agency invited consumers to join a class action lawsuit against Sony, which had canceled orders for a PlayStation 5 console that it had offered on its website in Mexico for a 30% discount. The consumer protection law is so well known in Mexico that people use social media to draw attention to erroneous prices on Amazon and other retailers' websites and posts that are widely seen and shared, according to El Economista, a newspaper in Mexico City that covers financial news. Mr. Villarreal said the consumer agency had summoned Cartier for arbitration and that the government had made several attempts to mediate an agreement. Agency officials said they could not share information about an open case with anyone other than the parties involved. If the Consumer Protection Agency finds that a company is at fault, it can impose fines or other penalties, but it can't force a company to abide by a price it listed, said Jorge López Zoyazaza, a corporate lawyer in Mexico City. If no agreement is reached, either party can ask for a judge to resolve the complaint. Mexican law does not extend protections to consumers if a listed price was clearly a mistake, Mr. Zazaya said. If this case had gone to a court of law, it probably would have resolved favorably for Cartier, he said. But there appeared to be a truce in the matter. Ahead of a consumer agency mediation hearing next week, Mr. Villarreal said on Monday he had received notice from Cartier that his order would be fulfilled, and then announced the earrings delivery on Friday. The agreement could not be confirmed with Cartier or the agency. War is over, he wrote in English in a social media post on Monday. Mr. Villarreal said on Friday that the earrings arrived, and he shared a photo of two small boxes wrapped in paper with wax seals. Once upon a December, he wrote in the social media post. Some users applauded his tenaciousness in getting Cartier to comply with the terms of his purchase, while others, including a Mexican senator, had accused him of abusing the consumer protection system for his own gain. "It's wrong to take advantage of a mistake to the detriment of another person," wrote Lily Tellez, a senator for the state of Sonora, adding, "even if the law supports you." Mr. Villarreal said he was happy that the ordeal was over, and he would sign an agreement to settle his complaint with the Consumer Protection Agency. Well, from Mexico, we go to New York. A $275 bus ticket to the Hamptons. Blade, after a decade of flying passengers to eastern Long Island on helicopters, is getting into the luxury coach business. This article is written by Andrew Zucker. Blade, the helicopter charter company, was founded 10 years ago as a way for commuters going between New York and the Hamptons to avoid vehicle traffic. This May, it's introducing a new service, the Hamptons Streamliner, that, starting at $195 a ticket, will take passengers to destinations on eastern Long Island aboard a bus. Like Blade's helicopters, seats on which start at $1,025, its buses are marketed as a luxurious option for Hamptons goers. Seats can recline up to 45 degrees, and passengers will be offered free refreshments like espresso martinis, pop-up bagels, and sweet green salads as they make their way from Manhattan to stops in Southampton, Bridgehampton, and Easthampton via the Long Island Expressway. Other amenities include a call button at each seat to get the attention of an attendant who can bring riders a snack, a drink, a hot towel, or a cashmere blanket. Those who spring for one of seven premium seats, which cost $275, can also ride with a pet for an additional fee. The 19-passenger coaches, of course, will be subject to the same gridlock and hours-long traffic delays any vehicle can encounter on the expressway, making the onboard perks a main draw, said Racine Branch, Blade's chief marketing officer. "This level of service is commensurate with what you would see in private aviation," she said. Ms. Branch said that Blade leaders saw a space in the market between more affordable Hamptons bus services like the 54-seat Jitney or 30-seat Ambassador, tickets for which start at $41 and $64 respectively, and pricier modes of transportation like helicopters, which have drawn mounting complaints from residents of New York City and the Hamptons about noise and other disruptions. The Hamptons Streamliner is a partnership between Blade and The Jet, a high-end coach service between New York and Washington, D.C., which supplied the two buses being used for the new transit service. "Each bus costs about $1 million to buy and outfit," said Chad Scarborough, the founder of The Jet. Operations will start just before Memorial Day weekend and run into the fall. Hamptons-bound buses will pick up passengers at only one location in Manhattan, Hudson Yards, the neighborhood of luxury apartment buildings, stores, and office towers occupied by technology companies like Meta and financial firms like BlackRock and Point 72. Buses returning to Manhattan will stop at an east side location before ending their route at Hudson Yards. "We wanted to make it an express," Ms. Branch said. "The less stops, the more premium it is for the community that we're serving." She added that Hudson Yards was chosen as a Streamliner's starting point with the hope that some Hamptons-bound people who work there will opt for a bus ride instead of driving or booking a chauffeured car. Bianca Delaseo, age 31, a real estate broker in New York, has taken both Blade helicopters and Jitney buses to the Hamptons. Ms. Delaseo, who appears in Selling the Hamptons, a real estate-focused reality TV show on the streaming service Max, described the Jitney as no frills and said a smaller bus experience offering more luxury could appeal to certain riders. But other commuters, like Chloe Heckner, age 23, who lives in New York and whose parents have a home in the Hamptons, saw less value in splurging on a more luxurious way to sit in traffic. Ms. Heckner, a recent graduate of Syracuse University, has occasionally taken ambassador buses, which offer passengers free wine and coffee, but said she preferred taking jitney buses because they're less expensive. If I want to spend a summer weekend out there, I would just rather get the cheapest, easiest way to get out, she said. They show a picture of this bus, and this is your standard 65-foot, over-the-road, streamliner bus. Think of like an executive charter or a Greyhound bus, but it only has 19 seats. I'm afraid it's out of my budget. Well, from buses to cigarettes. Biden delays ban on menthol cigarettes. The proposal has been years in the making, and it's been an effort to curb the death rates of black smokers targeted by big tobacco. In an election year, the president's worries about support among black voters may have influenced the postponement. This article is written by Christina Jewett and Noah Welland. The Biden administration said on Friday it was delaying a decision on whether to ban menthol cigarettes, effectively quashing a proposal that has divided black American voters and fueled million-dollar lobbying campaigns from the tobacco industry in this presidential election year. The White House has faced considerable resistance from the cigarette companies that would lose millions of dollars if they could no longer sell menthol cigarettes. Opponents took to the airwaves to warn of a spike in cartel traffic along the border from counterfeit cigarette smuggling and of police violence targeting black residents if a ban were in force. Those efforts posed risks for President Biden, whose support among black voters has at times slipped in recent months. Some of Mr. Biden's top health officials have said that a ban would save lives and protect against lung cancer, which is a higher risk for black smokers, who have historically favored menthol cigarettes and are heavily targeted by tobacco companies. This rule has garnered historic attention, and the public comment period has yielded an immense amount of feedback, including from various elements of the civil rights and criminal justice movement, Xavier Becerra, the Health and Human Services Secretary, said in the statement. It's clear there are still more conversations to have, and that will take significantly more time. The decision highlighted a debate among senior federal officials over how to weigh the political and legal consequences of a ban against public health. A White House spokeswoman declined to comment and referred to Mr. Becerra's statement. Mr. Becerra, the administration's highest-ranking health official, said in an interview earlier this year that he had continued to push the White House to support the ban. We started to pull this all together, the elements of a good proposal, to move on to something we've known for decades, that menthol is killing Americans in disproportionate numbers when it comes to smoking, he said. It should surprise no one that we're continuing to push till the very end, he said in the interview. Dr. Robert Califf, the Food and Drug Administration commissioner and a supporter of the ban, told House lawmakers at a budget hearing this month that he hoped regulators would be able to issue a decision by the end of the year. It's one of our top priorities, and I sure hope so, he said. Dr. Califf said that as a cardiologist who had practiced for more than 3 decades, he has seen more people die from tobacco-related illness than almost any physician because I was an intensivist who dealt with the end stage of the disease. From the point of view of the FDA and me as an individual, given what I've seen in my life, we're talking about over the next 30 years probably 600,000 deaths that could be averted, Dr. Califf said. Most would be black Americans who are consumers of the industry targets, he added. The FDA had previously described the effort as a critical piece of Mr. Biden's Cancer Moonshot initiative, noting that about 30% of all cancer deaths are caused by smoking. Studies projected that a ban could avert as many 650,000 smoking-related deaths. A majority of the Congressional Black Caucus supported the ban. On Friday, Derek Johnson, the president of the NAACP, rebuked the president, saying Mr. Biden was choosing politics over people's lives. Today's news from the Biden administration is a blow to the black community, who continue to be unfairly targeted and unjustly killed by big tobacco, Mr. Johnson said. Let's be clear. Valuing black lives should not be used as a pawn to get our people to the polls, but rather a platform that our leaders refuse to step down from. Democrats have fretted for months about Mr. Biden's soft support among black voters, in particularly black men. Polls have consistently shown Mr. Biden with support from a substantially smaller percentage of black men than he had in the 2020 election, which was itself a smaller portion than Democratic presidential candidates took in prior elections. The ban has also united an array of public health groups, including leading lung, heart, cancer, and pediatric associations. They cited years of data suggesting that menthol cigarettes, long marketed to African-American smokers, make it more palatable to start smoking and more difficult to stop. Many of those groups expressed outrage on Friday about the delay, which was first reported by the Wall Street Journal. The White House fell for industry rhetoric, and as a result, public health will suffer, said Dr. Karen E. Knudsen, chief executive of the American Cancer Society. The FDA formally proposed the ban in May of 2022, saying there were 18.5 million smokers who preferred menthol brands in the United States. Researchers looking at similar moves in other nations estimated that a ban could result in nearly a quarter of menthol smokers quitting altogether. The proposal made its way to the White House in October. Soon, official calendars were flooded with meeting requests, not only from supporters of the ban, but also from opponents, which included tobacco companies, convenience stores, and gas station retailers. They projected that the ban would cost them billions of dollars in sales. Reynolds American, which makes Newport menthol cigarettes, gave millions of dollars in recent years to political action funds that benefit Republican lawmakers, as well as $1 million in February to a fund supporting former President Donald J. Trump. "We strongly believe there are more effective ways to transition adult smokers away from cigarettes permanently," Luis Pinto, a spokesman for Reynolds, said in a statement. "We believe that providing access to potentially safer nicotine alternatives, like appropriately regulated flavored vaping products, including menthol, are critical in supporting adult smokers to migrate from combustible cigarettes." Altria, which makes some menthol Marlboro cigarettes, donated less than Reynolds, but also contributed to funds supporting Republican lawmakers. Republicans in Congress have denounced the proposed ban in letters to the Biden administration, warning that it would increase trafficking of counterfeit cigarettes. Republicans also mounted a failed effort last year to keep the government from funding any work on the ban. Opponents of the ban have sponsored primetime commercials criticizing the ban and saying it would fuel illicit tobacco trafficking and enrich the cartels. They've helped promote some black leaders' concerns that a ban would encourage law enforcement to target black smokers. Now, the FDA has said such a ban would be enforced on manufacturers. The Biden campaign has gone to significant lengths to bolster its support among black voters. It road-tested a series of get-out-the-vote methods and strategies in South Carolina ahead of the state's first-in-the-nation Democratic primary in February, and has since devoted resources and staged campaign events aimed at black voters in key general election battleground states. Reynolds has argued the ban would have serious unintended consequences, including more counterfeit cigarette use. Altria has raised the same argument, has also said that historically low and declining youth smoking rates do not justify pursuing a ban. Convenience store owners, who predicted that the ban would cost them billions, staged a demonstration in November in front of the Manhattan office of Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democratic Majority Leader. On hand were members of the National Action Network, who have acknowledged accepting tobacco funding over the years. They invited Gwen Carr, the mother of Eric Garner, who died after a police officer who suspected him of selling loose cigarettes placed him in a chokehold. She warned at the event that a menthol ban would increase such encounters with the police. "This will create more havoc in the black and brown communities," she said. In an interview after the event, Ms. Carr said she had not received money from tobacco companies. "I can't be bought," she said. The FDA had previously said it expected to see the menthol ban finalized by the end of the year 2023. As months passed, public health groups amped up pressure, staging a menthol funeral outside the White House in January to highlight the lost opportunity to extend lives and curb smoking-related disease. In April, Action on Smoking and Health, an advocacy group, and the African American Tobacco Control Leadership Council sued the administration in a bid for action. Tobacco industry arguments have prevailed over public health. Laurent Huber, the executive director of Action on Smoking and Health, said in a statement Friday, "There's no scientific research to support continuing to sell mentholated tobacco products." It is 26 minutes past the hour. You're listening to WRRS, the radio reading services for the Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. My name is Greg Wilkins, and I am reading from the business section of the New York Times for today, Sunday, April 28th, 2024. This next article, regulators seize Republic First, a troubled Philadelphia bank. The relatively small bank, the first to fail this year, will have its deposits assumed by another Pennsylvania lender, Fulton Bank. This article is written by Kashmir Hill. Regulators late Friday seized Republic First Bancorp, a troubled Philadelphia lender, in the first U.S. bank failure this year. Republic First Bancorp, known as Republic Bank, had about $4 billion in deposits at the end of January and assets worth $6 billion, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said in a statement. Substantially all of its deposits will be assumed by Fulton Bank of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, the FDIC said, with Republic First's 32 branches in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York reopening as soon as Saturday as Fulton Bank branches. Founded in the year 1988, Republic First was smaller than the mid-sized banks that collapsed last year, including First Republic Bank and Silicon Valley Bank, whose assets each topped $200 billion. The FDIC expects the cost to the deposit insurance fund to be $667 million. The failure comes amid continuing concern about the health of regional banks. In a presentation for investors in July, Republic First said that deposits were declining and that the bank's mortgage lending business had become less valuable as interest rates increased. It had planned to exit the mortgage business and refocus on consumer deposits. It was delisted by NASDAQ in August after it failed to file its annual report with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and an expected $35 million investment in the bank was scuttled this year, as reported by Banking Dive. Fetty Strickland, a bank analyst at Janney Montgomery Scott, said the Republic First failure was likely to be an isolated incident and that the overall banking sector is stable. "I think small banks are in good shape," Mr. Strickland said. "Some of the failures we saw last year were really banks within a certain specialization. I think there's an importance of being diversified." Mr. Strickland called Fulton, which is taking over Republic First deposits, a boring bank in the best way, calling the commercial bank careful and good operators. "Depositors should feel safe with Fulton," he added. Well, from bank sexing to building, exploring Pittsburgh's legacy of steel. At the Carnegie Museum of Art, an installation by the artist Marie Watt celebrates the region's industrial history with I-beams and glass. This article is written by Leslie Wayne. If there's one word that defines Pittsburgh's, it's steel. Steel is in Pittsburgh DNA. It's embedded in the name of the city's football team and is the source of the industrial wealth that put Pittsburgh on the map. This month, steel is being celebrated in a different way at the city's Carnegie Museum of Art. As part of its forum series of commissioned art from living artists, the museum will present Land Stitches, Water Sky, a multi-ton sculpture of steel by the interdisciplinary artist Marie Watt, that explores the region's industrial history with I-beams and glass. The exhibit opened April 13th and will be on display until September 22nd. Watt was selected because of her use of objects to tell stories and her willingness to work in partnership with the museum to produce a new and ambitious work of art, said Eric Crosby, the museum's director since the year 2020, in an interview he gave in New York. "We gravitated to her, and she gravitated to us," he said. Watt, a member of the Seneca Nation, tries through her work to connect the past with the present and to find links among disparate communities. Steele fits right in with her vision. It was Steele from Pittsburgh that helped build the Empire State Building and the George Washington Bridge in New York, and many other famous structures. And it was Mohawk Native Americans who have been celebrated in her past works, who worked on many of those projects, earning them the moniker Skywalkers for their daring feats on steel beams. "We are looking at the intersection of steel and Pittsburgh history," Watt said in a video interview. "After learning more about the industry and its origins in Pittsburgh, I've been thinking more about the impact of steel on the community here and how it intersects with my own understanding." That connection will be represented in the two arc-shaped collections of steel I-beams, over 20 feet long and weighing thousands of pounds, that allow viewers to walk through and contemplate a word bank from local poets etched into the steel. In addition, there are several glass I-beams in recognition of Pittsburgh's equally important past as a center of industrial glassmaking. As welders construct the structure, local poets have been adding words that will appear on beams: silence, bear, sky, ante, water, homestead, lantern, heirloom, elder. Known for her formations of stacked and folded blankets piled up to dizzying heights, Watt will be displaying an array of blankets near the steel piece. "Blankets are part of people's lives," she said. "They're stories and memories. Blankets are humble and simple, and yet can have so much meaning and power. Blankets are cinematic in scale, like a billboard, and can envelope the viewer in the material." Watt's works have been displayed at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Whitney Museum of Art in New York, the Seattle Art Museum, and the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville, Arkansas, among many others. She lives in Portland, Oregon, and is the 88th artist to be featured as part of Carnegie's Forum Series, which began in the year 1990. The idea is to bring artists to the museum to produce commissioned works while providing them with the resources of the museum and the community to inspire them and their creation. Exploring Pittsburgh is exactly what Watt has done. She has toured the Cary Blast Furnaces, a historical landmark at the former Homestead Steelworks and the site of one of the most important events in labor history, the violent 1892 strike between workers and private security guards hired by the company that ended in a defeat for unionizing efforts. She has also collaborated with the Pittsburgh Poetry Collective on the words that are to be etched into the I-beams, with the Pittsburgh Glass Center on the construction of the glass portion of the sculpture. Two Pittsburgh fabricators, D. Briggs Studio and Pokimoto, are doing the construction and the welding. While the steel beams will have text, the glass portion does not. "We're talking about presence and absence," Watts said of the glass. "Glass has been a significant part of Pittsburgh history, but the legacy of steel is so big that it's overshadowed the story of glass. This project is a way to connect the two. We take glass for granted and how glass has come to us." Watt's work and the Forum Series reflect some of what is unique about the Carnegie Museum of Art, one of a consortium of four museums that trace their roots back to their founder, the industrialist Andrew Carnegie. The other institutions under the umbrella of the Carnegie Museums of Pittsburgh are the Carnegie Museum of Natural History and the Carnegie Science Center and the Andy Warhol Museum. In the Carnegie Museum of Art, which was founded in 1895 by Carnegie with the goal, he said, of making Pittsburgh as famous for art as it is now for steel, at the time, in the art and in the business of Pittsburgh, His two main compatriots were Henry Clay Frick, a business partner in Carnegie Steel, which later became U.S. Steel, and Andrew Mellon, who financed U.S. Steel and many of Pittsburgh's other biggest companies. Sometimes rivals, sometimes partners, the three also took a keen interest in art, though with very different approaches. Frick and Mellon amassed collections of old masters that then became the core collections of two world-class museums, the Frick Collection in New York and the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., founded by Mellon. Carnegie, envisioning a museum that would house old masters of tomorrow, bought no paintings and instead donated money with the idea that the Museum of Art would go out and buy contemporary art, not art of the past. The museum remains committed to that vision today. Besides the Forum series, there is also the highly celebrated Carnegie International, started by Carnegie and held every 4 years. One of the longest-running surveys of international contemporary art, it brings together artists, filmmakers, performers, and curators from around the world. The first Carnegie International was held in 1896 to not only showcase modern art, but also allowed the museum to collect pieces from the exhibition. The first paintings to enter the Carnegie Museum collection came from the first international, most notably Winslow Homer's 1896 painting, The Wreck. Impressionist paintings didn't come into the museum until the mid-1960s, and the museum was a pioneer in showcasing photography and architecture long before they were in fashion. "We stopped thinking of the museum as a repository of a collection," Crosby said. "Instead, we think of it as a vital resource for the community. It calls back to 1896, where we can provide an abundance of art, space, and talent. Our responsibility is to try to be more of a listening museum for visitors, our patrons, and artists. It's within the DNA of the museum to collect fine art of the time and still be an encyclopedic museum. Like so many museums that used COVID-era closures to reimagine their profiles, Carnegie used that time to come up with new ways to engage the local community." "People don't need museums," said Dana Bishop Root, the museum's director of education and public programs, in a video interview. "Museums need people," she said. To that end, the Carnegie has opened its doors to seniors who come for chair yoga and drawing classes, to school teachers who are invited for a 3-week summer program to develop curriculum modules, and to hundreds of refugees who have received gifts of memberships and programs in their languages. "We want to introduce the museum as a site of belonging, and that it's as much of a part of the neighborhood as the grocery store," Bishop Root said. All these efforts have paid off, museum officials said. Attendance in the year 2023 reached a record 417,000, surpassing pre-pandemic levels. And gifts and grants grew to $9.4 million in the year 2022, compared with pre-pandemic levels in the $3 million to $5 million range, according to Crosby. "We want to be the best neighborhood museum we can be," Crosby said. "The museum can be a vital conduit to broaden the horizons of the citizens of the city. Pittsburgh has an incredible history, rich in materials from the region that can inspire." What is a decent wage? Francis Michelin raises the debate. The tire maker vowed to ensure that none of its workers would struggle to make ends meet. This article is written by Liz Alderman. When the French tire maker Michelin closed its factories during the coronavirus pandemic, Florent Mengeneau, the company's chief executive, took stock of the closure's impact on employees worldwide. Thousands of workers in Asia, Europe, and the United States at the lower end of the company's pay scales could barely get by. Michelin vowed to do better. Last week, the 134-year-old company, which has 132,000 workers at 131 factories in 26 countries, announced it would guarantee all of its employees a decent wage, wherever they were in the world, part of a broader social plan intended to ensure that none of its workers would have to struggle to make ends meet. "If workers are just in survival mode, it's a big problem," Mr. Mangano said in an interview. When the wealth distribution in a company is too unequal, that's a problem too. The announcement quickly ignited a debate in France over what exactly constitutes a decent wage and whether more French corporations should follow suit. Unions warned that the Michelin pledge would still leave some workers struggling and that it did not come with a guarantee against future layoffs or site closures. Corporations worldwide are looking to meet environmental, social, and governance targets. A lot of investors are backing away from ESG criteria, but some companies are signing up to become living wage employers, which commits them to...
This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
...worldwide are looking to meet environmental, social, and governance targets. A lot of investors are backing away from ESG criteria, but some companies are signing up to become living wage employers, which commits them to pay salaries that correspond to the cost of rent, food, transportation, and childcare in the regions where their workers live. In France, the cosmetics giant L'Oréal committed to a living wage and extended the pledge to its suppliers. Unilever is taking the same steps. Only 4% of the world's most influential companies have made similar commitments, according to the World Economic Forum. Michelin's salary pledge caught the attention of President Emmanuel Macron of France, who said he wanted companies to share more profits with its workers. His government is facing a political storm as households struggle with the cost of living crisis. The share of workers who earn France's gross monthly minimum wage of 1,766 euros, which is indexed, has surged to 17% of the workforce from 13% just a few years ago. The French Prime Minister, Gabriel Attal, has called for talks with trade groups and proposed tax changes to encourage businesses to pay more than the minimum wage, which social organizations say is often not enough for workers to get to the end of the month without government subsidies. Mr. Mengot declined to divulge how much Michelin's lowest-paid workers around the world have been earning, but said their pay was higher than the minimum wage where they lived, which he described as not a decent salary. He added that a living wage was a way to help improve employees at the bottom of the ladder move up. He decided to take action, he said, when the closure of Michelin's factories during the pandemic revealed weak societal safety nets worldwide. In France, the government shielded workers from layoffs by paying companies to put them on a partial furlough. But in other countries, such support either did not exist or was insufficient. In creating its decent wage, the company, known for its rubbery Michelin Man mascot, referred to standards set by the United Nations Global Compact, a salary enabling a family of four to live decently in the city where they work. That means not running out of money before the end of the month after paying basic expenses and being able to save and spend modestly on goods or leisure activities. Michelin turned to the Fair Wage Network, a non-governmental organization based in Switzerland, to assess its salary structure. The resulting study found that 5%, or around 7,000, of Michelin's employees worldwide were not earning enough. In response, Michelin adapted salary scales to the cost of living in cities when its factories operated. In Beijing, the group increased the lowest pay level to 69,312 yuan per year, or a little less than 9,000 pounds. In Greenville, South Carolina, workers' pay rose to the equivalent of 40,000 pounds per year. And there is no dollar translation in this article. In France, where the gross minimum wage is 21,203 pounds per year, the company lifted the salaries of its lower-paid workers to 39,638 pounds in Paris and 25,356 pounds in Clermont-Ferrand, where the company's headquarters are and where the cost of living is lower than in Paris. But spending money on a living wage has not worried Michelin's shareholders. The company's stock is at a five-year high. They expect Michelin to deliver, Mr. Mengao said, and we are still delivering. The wage increases are not totally benevolent. Michelin needs to improve its attractiveness and employee loyalty after worker turnover as factories soared in the wake of pandemic lockdowns. And paying better would help improve productivity, Mr. Mengao added. You will have a payback. Because when people are paid decently, they're fully engaged and they do better work, he said. Louis Morin, the director of L'Observatoire des Inégalités, a social watchdog organization, said Michelin's living wage pledge had shined a moral spotlight on one of the thorniest issues in capitalism. All enterprises should be asking themselves this question, he said. Those who hold the capital say work creates wealth, but the workers creating that value are often the least paid. In France, where half of all workers earn less than £2,100 after taxes per month, a worker is considered middle class with monthly pay of £1,500 to £2,800, according to L'Observatoire's data. Workers are considered rich if they earn more. The French carmaker Stellantis stoked widespread indignation when it announced last month that the 2023 salary of its chief executive, Carlos Tavares, could reach £36.5 million, 365 times the average compensation of Stellantis employees. Mr. Mengao asked that his 2023 salary be capped at £1.1 million. The company posted record operating income, its main profit metric, of £3.57 billion in the year 2023, and a 12.6% profit margin. Michelin spent £500 million on share buybacks last year. It's nice publicity that hides other things. Nicholas Robert, a representative for the Union Syndicale Solidaris, one of France's biggest labor organizations, said of Michelin's wage pledge. He said workers at the Clermont-Ferrand factories who got the living wage increases earned around £1,700 a month after taxes, not enough to support a family of four without welfare supplements. After you pay your housing, food, energy, and transport, not much is left, Mr. Robert said. What they call a decent salary is far from reality. We have many workers who have been in survival mode since inflation exploded. Mr. Mengao said the question of whether a company should accept lower margins or reduce share buybacks to dedicate more of a company's wealth to workers' salaries was a critical debate. I strongly believe that what makes a good corporation versus a corporation in difficulty is the level of social cohesion it achieves, he said. Personally, I think that globally, capitalism has gone a little bit too far. I believe in capitalism, but I think that when a salary doesn't pay enough for one person to project himself or herself into the future, then it's a problem. Oh, we have time for a couple more short ones, so turning to this week's Work Friend column. This ship is sinking. Can I jump to a client's? In the workplace, saving yourself is also your job. This column is written by Roxanne Gay. Ethics of Self-Preservation. I'm in a senior position with a marketing agency that is in bad shape. Employees are on reduced hours and pay because our work has slowed substantially. The owners have pledged to get new work, but have not made any moves in that direction. I'm looking for a new job, and I've seen some very appealing openings with current clients. I'd be a great candidate because I know many of the players, and they know and like my work. We don't have a non-compete, but I'm worried I would further harm my employer if I applied for a job with its clients. Will clients take it as a red flag? Will I accelerate the demise of my current company if I jump ship to a client? Signed, anonymous. You will not harm your employer by taking a new job with one of its clients. You are not responsible for your employer's demise. If the roles were reversed, it would not offer you a fraction of the consideration you're offering. It is a job, and maybe you love it. But, as I've said many times before, it will not and cannot love you back. If there are no non-compete issues, which may not matter anyway as the Federal Trade Commission banned most non-competes last week, By all means, take a job with a client. If the client asks why you're leaving your agency, you're welcome to offer a diplomatic answer or tell the truth. This is not an ethical quandary. It would be unethical only if, for example, you took a position with a client and then shared proprietary information about your former employer or its other clients. How about the overly conscientious boss? I manage a small, stellar team at a nonprofit. After annual reviews last year, I reached out to my supervisor to request raises for each member of my team and myself, factoring in both the annual cost of living raise and the merit raises I would like to see. I then shared what I was hoping to get each individual with that person, so they would know they had someone advocating for them. This seemed to be a good decision, at the time, to show I valued their hard work. However, we recently received our raise notifications, and while everyone did get a salary bump, we didn't quite hit the numbers I was hoping for. Now, based on some reactions, I'm worried that they're disappointed because expectations were set too high. Did I make a mistake in giving them the specific salary increases I was hoping for? How should I follow up? Should I follow up at all? Signed, Anonymous. Though you meant well, you did make a mistake. In the future, you can certainly tell members of your team you're going to push for raises, but don't give them exact numbers until you know what those numbers are. In this instance, you set your team up for disappointment, and that's what you're seeing right now. I'm not sure if you should follow up. It may just deepen any resentment they're feeling, a bit of salt in the wound. They probably don't care about your good intentions right now. The best path forward is to learn from this misstep, and don't be too hard on yourself. You're acting from a good place. I'd also think of some other ways you can show your team how much you value its hard work. The too many ideas guy. I work in social media on a digital media stream at a nonprofit. There are two strategists on the digital team. Their jobs are to help strategize, and my job is to manage and create content. One of the strategists has free range deciding when and how he will participate. For example, I'm responsible for managing the video content on our TikTok channel. At a meeting, this coworker announced we would introduce a weekly stream of video content that is not a good fit and does not align with the strategy I have been developing. Further, this coworker has never produced a video, so I'm not sure what role he would play. He becomes the de facto project manager of many of his ideas, directing those who have the skills to do the work. My supervisor considers this coworker a go-getter, but I think he's being anti-collaborative and posing more work on the rest of us. I try to stay out of all his projects. This, however, is still exhausting. His ideas are endless. If I did address this, how should I? People like this strategist thrive in the workplace because they're coming up with interesting ideas and don't trouble themselves to think how those ideas come to fruition. Management focuses on the ideas, valuing quantity, perhaps over quality, and doesn't really care who executes the ideas as long as they're executed. Of course, this is exhausting, particularly because it seems that the strategist is throwing things at the wall to see what sticks. If you want to address this, start by sharing how much you appreciate all of his enthusiasm and creative ideas, but then share that sometimes his ideas don't align with project aims and strategies, and that it would be great if you could meet and collaborate, focusing not just on generating ideas, but making sure those ideas are well aligned to organizational needs. If all else fails, become an idea person too. Grim prospects. I'm a 41-year-old creative media industry professional who has struggled to find full-time work since the pandemic. I was just beginning to reach the junior rung of the management ladder when workplaces shut down and companies began downsizing. I have the additional misfortune of having spent most of my career in an industry that has been roiling by restructuring, mergers, and mass layoffs. I have a master's degree from one of the most respected professional schools in my field, a wealth of experience and enthusiasm. Yet the jobs simply don't exist anymore for someone with my experience. I've been surviving on gig economy delivery jobs and dog walking for the past 4 years. I'm terrified I will never get back on my real career path. Do I start over in another field? I do have an arsenal of transferable skills. Do I go back to school? I'm single with no children and no property tying me to any one place. Signed, Anonymous. A shocking number of people in the media industry are in similar straits. Just this year, there have been mass layoffs at several companies and news organizations, and too few new jobs are being created to absorb so many job seekers. You are eminently qualified, and it's incredibly painful when being eminently qualified isn't enough. That being said, you can find yourself a new career path. You're going to have to think creatively. A lot of the ideas you suggested in your letter may prove fruitful. I have more questions than answers to offer. Start with looking at other fields where you can take your arsenal of transferable skills. What do you need to do to change career paths? How can you make as lateral a transfer as possible? If you return to school, have a plan and know what you're getting into. What do you want to study and why? What's the job market like in your field of study? Can you afford a graduate education or second undergraduate degree? If you take on student loans, will you be able to manage the debt burden? Finally, when you do apply for your new jobs, present your experience as an advantage. Highlight your creativity, resilience, leadership skills, and adaptability. Good luck as you move forward. It is either 2 minutes or 3 minutes before the hour, depending on what... both are saying 2 minutes before the hour. My signal to wrap things up. Until the same bat time and bat channel, this is Greg Wilkins. I've been reading from the Sunday, April 20th edition of the New York Times business section. I will not be with you next Sunday. I will be out working a volunteer for the 26th annual Flying Pig. Why I'm getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to do that is something I've been still trying to figure out. Stay safe, stay healthy. So long.